Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Why Do I Hate the Sound of My Own Voice? By Kate Samuelson. Have you ever recoiled at the sound of your own voicemail greeting, startled by what should be the most familiar of voices, your own? If so, then you're not alone. It's common to dislike the way your voice sounds in recordings, experts say. Here's why. You hear your own voice differently. When you hear people talking, sound waves travel through the air and into your ears, vibrating your eardrums. Your brain then transforms those vibrations into sound. However, when you're the one talking, your vocal cords and airways also vibrate. That means that you receive two sources of sound, the sound waves that travel into your ears from your own voice as well as vocal cord vibrations. When we talk, it's like everyone hears the sound through speakers, but we're hearing it through a cave complex inside our own heads, says Martin Birchall, professor of laryngology, the study of the larynx or voice box at University College London. The sound is going around our sinuses, all the empty spaces in our heads and the middle part of our ears, which changes the way we hear sounds compared to what other people hear. People perceive their own voice to be the combination of those two sources of sound, but everyone else just hears the external stimulus. This is why, when you listen to your voice in a recording, it sounds different than the voice you're used to. You're hearing only the external stimulus rather than the combination of the two sounds. People are bad at recognizing their own voice. Most people don't sit around listening to the sound of their own voice independently from talking, so they can become detached from how they actually sound. One study, during which people were played recordings of their own voices, found that just 38% of people were able to identify their own voice immediately. When we hear our own voice in a recording, it can often feel surprising and disappointing, Birchall says. We get used to the sound we hear in our heads, even though it's a distorted sound. We build our self-image and vocal self-image around what we hear rather than the reality. Birchall says this can be a particular problem for people with body or gender dysmorphia. For people with gender issues, hearing that their voice sounds like someone of the opposite sexes can be a really big issue, he says. We like to think that the way we're talking fits with our own gender identity, and when we feel we're in the wrong body or our voice isn't representative of who we are, then that can be a major deal. You're not necessarily stuck with your voice forever. If you're really disturbed by the sound of your voice, don't do what I do. Oh, sorry, that's an ad-lib. No, you have options, Birchall says. First, you can go to see a properly trained voice therapist, which is different from a speech therapist. Voice therapists work with patients to improve their cadence and the rhythms of their pitch by doing specific exercises, like working on breathing patterns by getting them to blow bubbles through a straw. It's like physiotherapy, but for the voice, he says. If voice therapy is unsuccessful, people can seek specialist psychologist support. It's also possible to make a person's pitch higher or lower through surgery, which is a common part of gender reassignment surgery. Is President Trump under investigation? Here's what we know. By Alana Abramson. When President Donald Trump abruptly fired James Comey last month, he wrote in the former FBI director's termination letter that he was appreciative of Comey telling him, on three separate occasions, that Trump himself was not under investigation, an assertion Comey confirmed in congressional testimony. But the last time Comey assured Trump of that was March 30th, and as he acknowledged repeatedly in his testimony, he was always aware that could change. Now it seems it is indeed changing, but there are conflicting signals about what is actually happening. The Washington Post reported on June 14th that Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who was appointed after Comey's termination to oversee the Russia investigation, has widened his probe to examine if the president attempted to obstruct justice or intentionally tamper with investigations surrounding himself or his associates. After the report was published, the president subsequently acknowledged in a tweet, "I am being investigated." On Sunday, however, a member of his legal team largely denied that, sparking a tense exchange with Fox News anchor Chris Wallace. Here's what you need to know. What has been reported about whether Trump is under investigation? On June 14th, the Washington Post reported that Mueller has expanded his investigation to determine if Trump had attempted to obstruct justice and was interviewing senior intelligence officials, Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats, Head of National Security Agency Mike Rogers, and Rogers' former deputy Richard Leggett as part of that probe. The Post cited multiple unnamed sources familiar with those interview requests. The assurances from Comey that the president wasn't under investigation were apparently no longer applicable, according to the Post report. The New York Times also reported that Mueller was seeking interviews with Coates, Rogers, and Leggett, although the report only described these interviews as an indication that Mueller was investigating if Trump obstructed justice. Coates and Rogers both declined to discuss private conversations with Trump during congressional testimony earlier this month, but the Post reported that Coates had told associates Trump had asked him to intervene with Comey when he was still FBI director to take the heat off former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and that Trump had asked Coates and Rogers to publicly deny any evidence of collusion between Trump associates and Russia during the 2016 election. Whether or not Mueller finds these reports to be valid will be hugely relevant to any finding of obstruction. What has Trump himself said? 2 days after the Post reported Mueller was investigating Trump for possible obstruction of justice, the president seemed to acknowledge as much himself in an early morning tweet that read, "I am being investigated for firing the FBI director by the man who told me to fire the FBI director. Witch hunt." Trump's tweet was most likely in reference to Deputy Attorney General Ron Rosenstein, whose memo he cited as justification for firing Comey and who had appointed Mueller as special counsel. But Trump has also said he had decided to fire Comey before Rosenstein wrote a memo recommending it. Mueller operates with day-to-day independence of Rosenstein, but Rosenstein still oversees how the investigation is funded. What has Trump's legal team said? Before Trump had tweeted he was under investigation, Mark Carollo, a spokesman for Trump's personal attorney Mark Cassowitz, did not deny the Post report, but questioned the legality of the leaking information about the investigation, calling it outrageous, inexcusable, and illegal. But on Sunday, Trump attorney Jay Sekulow appeared on four morning shows, initially denying that Trump was under investigation and explaining that Trump was merely tweeting he was under investigation in response to the story in the Post. He did tell Face the Nation's John Dickerson and Fox News' Chris Wallace, however, that he hadn't been notified of an investigation. "No one's notified us that he is under investigation, so I can't read people's minds, but I can tell you this, we have not been notified that there's an investigation to the President of the United States." Sekulow subsequently did tell Wallace that Trump was being investigated by the special counsel when he was asked, in reference to Trump's tweet, if the President thought Rosenstein had done anything wrong. Sekulow responded by citing what he called a constitutional issue with this situation, explaining that Trump had taken action to fire Comey partially based on recommendations from Rosenstein and is now facing an investigation from the Department of Justice because that's who Mueller reports to. "He's being investigated for taking the action that the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General recommended him to take by the agency who recommended the termination," Sekulow concluded. "That's the constitutional threshold question here." A spokesperson for Cassowitz did not return request for comment about Sekulow's interview. When Wallace pointed out that Sekulow had just admitted the president was under investigation, Sekulow reiterated that he had not been notified of anything. "I do not appreciate you putting words in my mouth," he told Wallace. Flight attendants say angry passengers are creating a big safety problem on planes. By Melissa Chan and Alex Fitzpatrick. The fury has died down, but the rash of viral confrontations on airplanes is still very much on flight attendants' minds. They are demoralized and anxious, afraid of becoming the villain in a cell phone video that spreads across the globe, creating a situation some say could result in safety lapses on planes. Several flight attendants who spoke to Time said they've seen colleagues ignore unbuckled belts, incorrectly placed bags, and similar violations of federal safety rules in order to avoid sparking confrontations with passengers. A lot of flight attendants feel uncomfortable performing essential job functions and responsibilities because one angry person can change our employment status, said Ben, a flight attendant working for a major airline who spoke on condition that his last name not be used. The recent tensions between flyers and crew arose in April when a video posted online showed a passenger being dragged off a United Airlines flight after refusing to give up his seat. 2 weeks later, an American Airlines flight attendant was suspended after yanking a stroller from a mother, leading to a heated argument that was caught on camera. And just last month, a family was kicked off a JetBlue flight after a dispute with a flight attendant over where to store a birthday cake. While it's still relatively rare for trouble to brew aboard flights, smartphone videos posted to social media make the incidents seem more frequent, creating friction in the cabin at a moment when confrontations can quickly spiral into viral moments. Since the United episode, in which passenger David Dow was left bloodied and with a concussion after being forced to give up his seat, flight attendants said they started noticing an attitude shift among passengers. Just about every other flight, I would have a passenger make a reference to the United Airways incident and be like, well, you guys are always saying, please fasten your seatbelt, put up your tray tables, pull your seat back forward. What if I don't? Are you going to drag me off the plane like they did on United? Said Jenny, a flight attendant for nearly 20 years who declined to give her last name. If flight attendants don't have the respect of their passengers, some experts say there could be far more serious problems than an unbuckled seatbelt. Passengers who don't obey rules could mean chaos in a true emergency, said Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants, which represents 50,000 members at 20 airlines. If we have not established that authority and passengers are not listening to flight attendants, it can be catastrophic, Nelson said. It can be the demise of an entire airplane. Not all agree with such dire predictions. John Cox, a retired U.S. Airways captain who now runs aviation safety consulting firm Safety Operating Systems, acknowledged that flight attendants are under intense pressure, but he does not believe that poses a safety threat. There's always pandemonium during a life-threatening evacuation, Cox said, but history has shown us that when you stress people to that level, they turn to who they believe is the expert on scene. Every time, it's the flight attendant. The recent incidents have drawn new attention to customer complaints about airlines. Passengers filed 1,909 complaints with the Department of Transportation in April, a 70% bump year over year, and a 69% increase from March. The gripes mostly involved flight cancellations and delays, lost baggage, and ticketing issues. Airlines have also been criticized lately for finding clever ways to raise prices, experimenting with reduced legroom, and struggling with massive delays caused by computer outages. After the United incident, several major airlines reviewed their policies and made changes. United instituted a new rule that employees could not revoke a passenger's seat after he or she had already boarded, according to a news release the airline issued in April. United also pledged to limit its use of law enforcement in future cases of disputes with passengers. When asked about the safety concerns flight attendants have raised in the wake of the incidents, United and JetBlue did not respond to requests for comment. American referred to a memo its CEO Doug Parker sent to employees in late May. In the note, Parker says, "The dedication and commitment to customer service for everyone in our industry has recently been called into question. We now live in a world where all eyes and video cameras are on us," he wrote, later adding that the airline would offer web-based training in de-escalating conflicts. Delta provided a statement through a flight attendant named Matthew Palmer, who said the company's leaders are working directly with us to find solutions and set them in place quickly. The social media effect has certainly had an impact on our jobs, but my colleagues and I are safety professionals, and we remain focused on working with our customers to ensure safety is taken seriously, the statement said. Not only do the people on the ground have our backs, but we have the tools at our fingertips to get ahead of a customer issue and make it right, even at 30,000 feet. The Federal Aviation Administration did not directly respond to the potential safety risks raised by flight attendants. A flight attendant's primary responsibility is aviation safety, the FAA said in a statement. Flight attendants provide passengers with a safety briefing, remind them to comply with FAA safety regulations, and provide instructions during an emergency. Our nation's flight attendants are well-trained professionals who are required to comply with the FAA's regulations. This is not the first time tensions have arisen between flight attendants and crew. There were similar levels of air rage in the late 1990s as America's skies saw a spike in unruly passengers confronting or attacking airline personnel. At the time, the solution involved harsher penalties for interfering with crew members. Now, flight attendants say airlines need to do a better job of teaching passengers that attendants' primary duty is safety, not customer service. We don't go to training every year to learn how to serve Cokes, said Stephen, also a longtime flight attendant with a major U.S. airline. Others say it's a matter of catching problems well before takeoff. We're paying more attention to the customers coming on board, paying more attention to the attitudes that are coming on board, Ben said. And if there's any negativity, we address it before the door closes.
The Mexican border newspaper that died with its star reporter, by Josh Robb. For 27 years, Mexican newspaper Norte de Ciudad Juarez employed over 125 journalists and a team of a dozen photographers to cover life in the border city of Juarez. The lives of the newspaper's journalists were often threatened, but the assassination of Miroslava Breach was a horror too far. The senior reporter was shot dead as she pulled her car out of her garage with one of her kids inside. A sign was left at the crime scene that read, "Tattletale." After 27 years of service, its founder Oscar Cantu had had enough. "We have 99.95% impunity in Mexico. I realized if we kept doing what we are doing, we're not going to get results." Cantu felt he could no longer guarantee the safety of his journalists, and without that security, they could no longer safely conduct critical journalism. So he closed down both the print and digital publications of the regional newspaper. "I closed in protest," he says. Over a long career, Miroslava had reported on organized crime, corruption, and human rights issues for La Jornada, a national newspaper, and Norte de Juarez. Cantu worked closely with Breach throughout her career. "I truly believe we lost one of the best journalists that we had in the state of Chihuahua," he tells Time. "It was a very clear message. She was a strategic target. I have never been so emotionally touched as I had regarding Miroslava. I believe I was the last person that she talked to the night before." In 1990, Cantu moved his paper from Chihuahua City to Juarez because he felt the citizens there needed a voice. "To defend ourselves against politicians, there is no better tool than public opinion." At the time of Norte's closure, its distribution had grown to 35,000, becoming the largest newspaper in Chihuahua, Mexico's largest state. It employed 300 people, including 125 journalists. Norte had a dozen staff photographers, but was down to only a few when it closed. Juan Carlos Hernandez Lopez, a photographer and graphic reporter for the paper, was on the team covering Miroslava's death. During their reporting, they say they were followed by at least four people who were taking pictures of them and asking locals about their reporting. Lopez also spoke to Time about less subtle encounters that he claimed happened regularly. Last August, as he covered the divorce proceedings of a business magnate, Juan was pushed to the ground by one of the guards. He was then offered 60,000 pesos, approximately $3,200, to delete the photograph he had succeeded in taking, Lopez says. Instead, Norte published the photo the next day. The worldwide reaction to the paper's closure surprised even Cantu. For almost 10 days, from all parts of the world, the Secretary of the Interior came to visit that they're going to do everything they could to get the criminals. I haven't seen any results from them. Despite closing the publication, Cantu still employs the majority of the newsroom to work on important projects that they had begun before Norte closed. These are stories that don't really have a deadline. There are one or two stories that are very interesting, and we're trying to figure out what we can do to get them out. Cantu is hoping to find a way to reopen the newspaper as a community project. It is unclear where exactly the funding will come from, but he hopes the local population it has helped to keep informed for all of these years will help to keep Norte and its tradition of reporting alive. Why Transgender People Suffer from ID Anxiety by Jacob Tobia. Think about the last time you went through TSA before getting on a flight. No matter how well you packed or how often you've traveled, the experience probably managed to be a relatively unpleasant one. As you got in line, you might have been worried about how far away your gate was, about whether or not your flight would be delayed, or about if your feet were going to smell when you took your shoes off. If there was traffic on the way to the airport, you might have even been quietly, or not so quietly, panicking that you were going to miss your flight. But odds are, no matter how stressed you were, you weren't worried about missing your flight because the gender on your ID didn't match how the TSA officer perceived you. For trans people, ID anxiety can be an almost daily occurrence. As a gender nonconforming writer and producer, I travel at least once a month to make appearances at events or perform at colleges and universities. Each time I go through TSA, I take a deep breath and say a prayer that the officer at the podium won't take one look at my dress, then the M on my driver's license, and decide that I need to be held for more thorough questioning. This anxiety isn't just limited to TSA. When I see blue lights behind me on the highway and I worry that I'm being pulled over for a speeding ticket, ID anxiety kicks in again. When a police car drives up behind me, my first thought isn't, I wonder how much the fine's going to be. My first thought is, oh God, what am I wearing today? Am I wearing too much makeup? Will this dress be a problem? Is the officer going to have an issue with the M on my license? No one deserves to miss their flight because their gender marker strikes the TSA agent as strange given the person who is standing in front of them. No student deserves to have more trouble with their school administration because of an M or an F that is assigned to their name. No person, transgender or otherwise, should have to worry about being taken to jail or down to the precinct because their identity documents have a flaw. And at the end of the day, why do we have gender markers on our ID documents in the first place? What purpose do they serve? What compelling state interest requires them to be there? Think about it. If you're going to steal someone's identity, what are the odds that you're going to get their social security number and name right, but their gender marker wrong? If you're going to use a fake ID to board a plane, are you really going to be incorrect about the person's gender whom you're impersonating? Or if you're going to make a fake ID to get into a club, is the gender marker really going to be the part that messes you up? Other than facilitating discrimination against transgender people, I am hard-pressed to identify the purpose served by the gender marker on our ID documents. Even in medical contexts, they're virtually useless and often lead to discriminatory or suboptimal treatment. For medical purposes, your gender marker is supposed to describe a predetermined set of bodily characteristics. But what if you're a transgender woman who was assigned male at birth, has taken estrogen for over 2 decades, has breasts, and medically has a penis? Neither an M nor an F can help a doctor understand your unique medical history. So what purpose does the gender marker on your ID really serve in helping the doctor to provide accurate, non-discriminatory, trans-inclusive health care? Clearly, we still have some fairly serious gender problems to solve. As a society, we have to begin redefining the role played by gender markers. That's why, along with the rest of the transgender community, I am ecstatic about a recently proposed bill in California that would create a gender-neutral designation on state ID documents and allow individuals to change their gender marker without undergoing clinical treatment or getting a court order. If passed, the proposed law, Senate Bill 179, would represent a historic leap forward for the transgender community in California and across the country. As a genderqueer person living in Los Angeles, I could then apply for a new driver's license at the California DMV that simply listed non-binary in the gender category. The impact of having that on my driver's license would be profound. I'd no longer have to worry about getting strange looks from TSA officers, and instead of assuming that I want a man to pat me down, they would simply ask me if I had a preference for a man or a woman. When being pulled over by a police officer, I wouldn't have to worry anymore about my gender being treated as some sort of interrogation or have to deal with the implications of simultaneously having makeup on my face and an M on my license. I'm not sure that any visit to the DMV will ever be a pleasant experience, and I'm certain that unflattering driver's license photos will continue to be a problem for generations to come, but creating a third option on licenses and waiving clinical requirements in order to change your gender marker is a big step in the right direction. These measures will allow all transgender people greater options and the ability to choose the option that works best for them. It's hard enough to navigate the world as a transgender person. The least we can do is ensure that your driver's license doesn't have to make it any harder. Attack at London mosque comes as UK Muslims see surge of hatred. By Kate Samuelson. At least 9 people were injured after a van drove into worshippers by the Finsbury Park Mosque in North London just after midnight on Sunday night. The incident, which took place nearly a year to the day after British Labour Party politician Joe Cox was murdered by a far-right extremist, is the 4th fatal terrorist attack on UK soil this year. Although little can be reported about the 48-year-old chief suspect, who is white, eyewitness reports suggest the targets of the attack were chosen deliberately. The method was the same used by terrorists on London Bridge earlier this month and Westminster Bridge in March. One thing is increasingly clear. The attack on practicing Muslims breaking their Ramadan fasts comes at a time when Muslims living in the UK are reporting a huge spike in hatred directed towards them, leaving them fearful of more such assaults on their communities and places of worship. Figures released by Tell Mama, measuring anti-Muslim attacks, show that verified reports of instances of anti-Muslim hatred increased by 530% in the week following the suicide attack at an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester on May 22nd, compared to 1 week before the incident. The organization also said there was a 240% increase in verified instances of anti-Muslim hate in the 7-day period following the London Bridge attack on June 3rd. The mayor of London's office also recorded a 5-fold increase in Islamophobic attacks after the London Bridge attack. The instances reported to Tell Mama can range from violence to general abuse, including name-calling and intimidation, says Fiaz Muhal, the group's founder and former director. Whenever there's a major terrorism incident, there's a big sharp rise in anti-Muslim hate that's reported to us, he says. We noticed very similar trends after the murder of Lee Rigby in 2013 and the attack on the Charlie Hebdo office in Paris in 2015. McCall ran a hate crime awareness session on Friday at the Muslim Welfare House Mosque in Finsbury Park, around 20 yards from where Sunday's incident occurred, just 48 hours before the attack. It was just a matter of time, he says. It was not a matter of if, it was when. McCall said around 70 people attended the session, during which he made various recommendations, including text someone to tell them if you're going down to the mosque, don't cluster near the entrance of your mosque, and avoid standing in large congregations. We will continue to run these sessions, McCall says. We'll keep saying to mosques, you don't have to put up tents, don't have to put up guards, you just need to make people aware of their surroundings. The rise in hate crimes directed at Muslims can be linked to increased violence among far-right groups in the UK. Joe Mulhall, a senior researcher at Hope Not Hate, an advocacy group that aims to challenge mistrust and racism through research, education, and public engagement, tells Time that the British far right is going through a period where it is more violent than it has been in some time. According to Mulhall, there are around 40 small but quite extreme far-right groups in the UK, which do not fall under one umbrella organization as they have done in the past. You get lots of groups that completely condemn violence, but they contribute to an ecosystem where violence becomes more legitimized, especially towards Muslims, he says. Last Sunday, an anti-Muslim demonstration titled UK Against Hate took place in Manchester, the scene of an attack on May 22nd, attracting around 2,000 people. It was the largest such demonstration that's taken place in the UK for a number of years, Mulhall says. There's clearly a huge amount of anger at the moment in the wake of these Islamist attacks, and there's people willing to try and exploit that. Prime Minister Theresa May said in a speech on Downing Street Monday morning that extra police resources have been deployed to reassure communities following the Finsbury Park attack, adding that officers are assessing the security needs of mosques and will provide any additional resources needed. To Mughal, more police is not the answer. We don't want to see visible policing outside mosques. We don't want to divide communities from other communities, he says. I think the Jewish community's answer is the best one. They ask volunteers from their own community to hang around outside synagogues and be a nice, smiley presence there as people come in and out. We haven't even got that. In some mosques, there's absolutely no security. No one will even ask me who I am. But others say they would welcome a more visible presence by authorities in the wake of the attack. Saja Mughal, executive director of the JAN Trust, an NGO that supports black, Asian, minority ethnic and refugee women and young people, said she would like to see more of a police presence outside mosques, as well as in areas with a high proportion of Muslims. What I'm hearing on the ground, particularly from locals, is that they're concerned, she tells Time. Mughal, who says she has been personally targeted by far-right extremists in the form of hate mail, death threats, and vandalism to her property, said her organization has recorded a 31% rise in Islamophobic hate crime directed at Muslim women in 2017 compared to 2016. She believes women are specifically targeted both because they are often more easily identifiable as Muslims and also because they tend to be depicted as weak, meek, and vulnerable targets. A number of the women who contacted the JAN Trust were victimized while carrying out their everyday activities, such as taking their kids to school. Mughal said, as well as receiving a spike in reports from Muslim women, the organization is receiving increased numbers of reports from their children. When Muslim women suffer, their children notice and then ask a lot of questions. I saw this in Finsbury Park yesterday. There was a lot of tension there, Mughal tells Time. We cannot let these attacks divide the community in any way, because that's exactly what they want us to do. If we do, we will be feeding into the extremist narrative, both on the far-right side of things, as well as on the Islamist extremist side of things. Fiaz Mughal echoed her comments. Islamist extremism loves the victimization narrative. It thrives on Muslims feeling victimized, he says. As well as providing some kind of safeguard, the best thing we can do now is to make Muslims feel empowered. Gretchen Carlson on Uber, Wonder Woman, and Bill Cosby by Gretchen Carlson. For eternity, women have been receiving mixed messages about who we're supposed to be, particularly in the workplace. In the early 1990s, when I was just getting started in television news, magazine articles and advice columns told women we had to be more like men to find success. That meant changing things like our wardrobes, wearing pantsuits and blazers to somehow embrace our masculine sides. But just as soon as we got the hang of that, it all seemed to change. Suddenly, the secret to success was to focus on our femininity. In the decade that followed, books, magazines, and newspaper headlines told us to celebrate our best female qualities. So, which one was it? Reading several different news headlines over the last few weeks, I found myself asking the same question again. What messages are women getting about who we're supposed to be? And are those messages still mixed in 2017? Let's start with the good news. I let out a sigh of relief when Wonder Woman became a record-breaking hit at the box office. Thankfully, naysayers wouldn't be able to claim that a movie directed by and starring women couldn't cut it. The film is still dominating the box office, having pulled in $572 million worldwide to date. But the big question now is whether Hollywood, where women are still underrepresented and underpaid, will learn from the Wonder Woman example. Some positive news recently also came out of Uber's sexual harassment probe. The company, facing allegations by former engineer Susan Fowler and others, revealed last week that it fired 20 employees after a report by former Attorney General Eric Holder, hired by the company to investigate the claims and corporate culture. Though there's still vast room for improvement, it appears the company is taking sexism and harassment seriously. CEO Travis Kalanick is taking a leave of absence, and board member David Bonderman immediately stepped down after his alleged sexist comments came to light. Will more women be hired for positions too often filled by men? Will more companies take measures to combat systemic sexism? I'd like to shout a resounding yes to both questions, but I hesitate because in other recent news headlines, it's impossible to escape the mixed messages women continue to get. Take the Bill Cosby trial, for example, which resulted in a mistrial Saturday. Andrea Constant had accused the comedian of drugging and sexually assaulting her in 2004. Dozens of other women have accused Cosby of similar crimes, some of which Cosby previously admitted to in court and others of which he denies. On the first day of the trial, Cosby had arrived with a woman standing by his side, Keisha Knight Pulliam, one of his co-stars from The Cosby Show. It's often an effective strategy to show women supporting a man accused of doing something horrible to women. The message is, how could he have done it if other women support him? Pulliam claimed in a television interview that she was standing by Cosby because that's just not the man that I ever experienced. Well, I too met Cosby almost 30 years ago when I was Miss America, and like Pulliam, I didn't experience anything untoward. But that's not the point. You often hear the same kind of sentiments in sexual harassment cases. That's not the man I know. He never did anything like that to me. Or if that kind of behavior was going on, I would have heard about it. The problem is that sexual harassers and abusers don't treat every person they come into contact with in the same way. Harassers don't harass everyone. They often choose their targets carefully. And while we live in a country that rightly presumes that a criminal defendant is innocent until proven guilty, I believe this kind of female support contributes to the mixed messaging. There is no right way for a woman to be, save for equal to a man. No mixed messages there.
Teens are getting more depressed but using fewer drugs, by Lon Tweeten and Alice Park. The latest snapshot of mental health and substance abuse among teens and adults tells a mixed story of optimism and opportunities for improvement. While teens are using fewer substances now than in the past, the overall opioid epidemic shows no signs of slowing. The data compiled by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the SAMHSA, comes from two large national surveys reported in 2015. Here are some of the key findings. Fewer teens are using illegal drugs. While marijuana is the substance teens are most likely to abuse, rates of pot usage have also declined slightly since 2011. Fewer teens started using alcohol, marijuana, or cigarettes in 2015 than in 2011. Cigarette use in particular has been steadily dropping from nearly 8% in 2011 to 4.2% in 2015. However, it's not all good news. While rates of substance abuse are dropping among teens, those who do abuse illicit drugs are not receiving the treatment that could help them with their addiction. Depression affects more teens. Rates of depression have been steadily rising among young people, especially girls, since 2011. An estimated 3 million teens reported having at least one major depressive episode in the past year in the 2015 survey. Opioid abuse affects all ages. Abuse of prescription painkillers is a growing problem, and nearly 5% of the U.S. population over age 12 reports misusing a prescription pain medication in the past year. Some of the increasingly popular and controversial medications, such as methadone and buprenorphine that are used to treat opiate addictions by mimicking the opioid drugs themselves, are also among the drugs being misused. Most worrisome are opiates like fentanyl, which, when obtained illegally, aren't always pure and are contributing to more overdose deaths. How people get prescription pain drugs. Overprescribing of opiate medications for conditions from headaches to dental surgery and major surgery has contributed to abuse. Because they're addictive, users often find other sources of drugs when their prescriptions run out. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.